A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to understand how audio fingerprinting actually works under the hood. Not the surface level. It matches Song's version, but the real mechanics. Spectrogram peak picking, constellation maps, hash pairs. And he wants us to bring it home with a meta example, because we just added fingerprinting to the My Weird Prompts pipeline ourselves, which we did. And I have to say, it's one of the more elegant things we've built.
It really is. And by the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro writing the script, which feels appropriate for a topic about clever matching algorithms.
So where do we start with this? Most people know audio fingerprinting as the thing Shazam does when you hold your phone up to a speaker and it magically names the song in 3 seconds, or Content ID on YouTube automatically detecting copyrighted music. Same underlying technology, but the use cases are wildly different.
The original Shazam paper is one of my favorite technical papers ever written. Avery Wang published it in 2003, and it's remarkably readable. The core insight is so clean. You're trying to identify a short audio clip from a database of millions of songs, and the clip might be recorded in a noisy bar through a terrible phone microphone. So whatever fingerprint you create has to survive compression artifacts, background noise, pitch shifts, EQ changes, all of it. And it has to do the lookup in a fraction of a second against an enormous database.
That's the part that still feels like black magic to most people. How do you take a garbled 10-second recording and match it against millions of tracks near instantly?
Let's walk through it step by step. Step 1 is you take the audio and you run a Fourier transform on it. Specifically, a short-time Fourier transform, which breaks the audio into tiny overlapping time windows and computes the frequency spectrum for each window. What you get is a spectrogram. Time on one axis, frequency on the other, and intensity as the brightness or amplitude at each point. You're essentially seeing which frequencies are loudest at each moment in time.
This is where the first clever filtering happens. You don't keep all that data. You do something called peak picking.
Peak picking is the first big filter. You scan the spectrogram and you only keep the points that are local maxima, frequencies that are louder than their immediate neighbors in both time and frequency. What you're doing is discarding everything except the most energetically distinct moments. In a piece of music, those peaks tend to correspond to things like vocal formants, drum hits, strong harmonic overtones, the stuff that cuts through.
The reason this matters for noise resistance. Background noise tends to be spread relatively evenly across frequencies. It fills in the valleys, but it rarely creates new peaks that are louder than the actual musical content. So by only keeping peaks, you're naturally filtering out a lot of the noise.
And you also set a threshold. You don't keep every tiny local maximum. You only keep peaks above a certain amplitude relative to the surrounding spectral content. The original Shazam paper describes keeping somewhere between 1 and 3 peaks per time frame on average. You're reducing an enormous amount of raw audio data down to a sparse set of coordinates. Each one is just a time and a frequency.
Now you've got this sparse scatter plot of dots. Time on the x-axis, frequency on the y-axis. And this is where the really elegant part comes in. You turn that scatter plot into what's called a constellation map.
The constellation map metaphor is perfect. If you look at these peak points plotted on a two-dimensional graph, they genuinely look like stars in the night sky. And just like with celestial navigation, you can identify a patch of sky by the relative positions of the brightest stars. You don't need absolute coordinates, you need the relationships between points.
How do you encode those relationships?
This is step 3, and it's the heart of the whole thing. You take each anchor point in the constellation map, and you pair it with several nearby points within a fixed time window ahead of it. For each pair, you create a hash that combines 3 values: the frequency of the anchor point, the frequency of the target point, and the time delta between them. That triplet becomes the fingerprint hash. And critically, the absolute time offset is not part of the hash. You're only storing relative timing.
That's the move that makes the whole thing work. Because when someone records a song in a bar, you don't know where in the song their recording starts. The absolute timestamps are meaningless. But the relative distances between peaks are preserved, regardless of when the recording began. You've stripped away the one piece of information that would break the match.
The hash itself is just a 32-bit integer. You pack the anchor frequency, target frequency, and time delta into a single number. That number becomes the key in a massive database lookup table. The value associated with that key is the song ID and the absolute time offset where that hash occurs in the original reference track.
When you do a lookup, you take the query audio, generate all its hashes the same way, and for each hash you pull up every song in the database that contains that same hash. Most hashes will match multiple songs or none, but if you get enough hashes that all point to the same song with consistent relative timing, you've got your match.
This is where the statistics get beautiful. A single hash match means almost nothing. It could be a random collision. But if you get 15 or 20 hashes that all agree on the same song, and the relative time offsets are internally consistent, the probability of that happening by chance is astronomically low. The original Shazam paper reports that with just 1 to 2 seconds of audio, you can get reliable identification even in noisy conditions.
What I love about this is that the database lookup is essentially a voting mechanism. Each hash gets one vote for a particular song at a particular time offset. You plot all the votes on a histogram, song ID on one axis, time offset on the other, and you look for a spike. If one specific song at one specific time offset gets dramatically more votes than anything else, that's your match. It's almost comically simple once you see it laid out.
It's fast because you're not comparing audio waveforms directly. You're doing integer hash lookups in a database that's indexed for exactly that operation. A 10-second clip might generate a few hundred hashes. Each hash lookup against a database of millions of songs takes microseconds. The whole thing resolves in well under a second.
Let's talk about what makes this robust, because it's not obvious. You mentioned noisy bar recordings, but it also survives pitch shifting, speed changes within a few percent, EQ filtering, compression artifacts, even pretty aggressive codec degradation.
Several factors working together. First, the peak picking threshold means you're only keeping the most prominent spectral features, which tend to survive compression and EQ changes. Second, the frequency bins used in the spectrogram have some width to them. You're quantizing frequencies into bands, so small pitch variations don't shift a peak into a different bin. Third, the time delta between peaks is relatively insensitive to small speed changes. If the recording is 2% faster, all the time deltas shrink by 2%, but the relative ordering of peaks stays the same and the hashes still match within tolerance.
There's also the sheer redundancy. A typical song generates thousands of hashes. You only need a small fraction of them to match for a confident identification. Even if 70% of your peaks get wiped out by noise or compression, the surviving 30% is more than enough.
The content ID system that YouTube uses works on the same principles, but at a staggering scale. YouTube has to check every single uploaded video against a reference database of tens of millions of copyrighted works. They're processing over 500 hours of video uploaded every minute. The fingerprinting has to happen in near real time during the upload process, and it has to handle every conceivable type of audio degradation. Background music in a vlog, someone singing a song, a cappella, sped up or slowed down versions, pitch shifted versions, you name it.
Content ID isn't just identifying the song. It's also determining exactly which portion of the song is being used, and for how long. That's where the time offset information in the hash database becomes crucial. Once you've matched enough hashes to identify the reference track, the consistent time offsets among those matching hashes tell you precisely which segment of the original recording is present in the uploaded video.
Which brings us to the example Daniel wanted us to discuss. Because we're not using this for copyright enforcement, we're using it for something much more niche and, honestly, much more fun.
Here's what we built. The My Weird Prompts production pipeline generates episodes from text scripts using TTS, text-to-speech. The TTS output is variable in length. Different models, different voices, different speaking rates. The same script can produce audio files that differ by 30 seconds or more, And when you're stitching together segments from different TTS runs, timestamps become useless.
This was the problem that led us to audio fingerprinting. We have certain fixed segments in every episode, the disclaimer, Hilbert's daily fun fact, the closing. These segments have predictable, consistent audio content. The words are always the same, spoken by the same voice, so we can pre-compute fingerprint hashes for those reference segments and store them. Then, when we generate a full episode, we fingerprint the entire audio file, do a lookup for those reference hashes, and we immediately know exactly where each segment begins and ends in that specific TTS output.
Without ever looking at a single timestamp.
And this is the key insight Daniel wanted us to get across. Timestamp-based slicing assumes you know in advance how long everything is. With variable length TTS output, you don't. The same sentence might take 4.3 seconds with one voice and 5.1 seconds with another. If you're slicing at fixed timestamps, you're going to cut in the middle of words. But audio fingerprinting locates the content itself, regardless of when it occurs.
The elegance of it is that the fingerprint doesn't care about tempo or absolute position. It only cares about the spectral shape of the audio. So, if the disclaimer is spoken slightly faster or slower in a particular TTS run, the constellation map shifts slightly in time, but the relative relationships between peaks stay the same. The hashes still match.
We designed the reference segments to be particularly fingerprintable. We chose phrases with strong consonant clusters and distinct vowel formants, things that produce clear, isolated spectral peaks. The phrase, my weird prompts, itself has some nice sharp transients. The M onset, the P plosive, the S fricative. All of those create distinctive patterns in the spectrogram.
We're also embedding what are essentially audio markers, brief, consistent sounds at predictable points that serve as highly fingerprintable anchors. Nothing the listener would notice, just natural sounding elements that happen to produce clean spectral peaks for the constellation map to latch onto.
The pipeline works like this. We maintain a reference database of fingerprint hashes for each segment we want to locate. The disclaimer, the fun fact intro, the closing. When a new episode is generated, we compute the full spectrogram, pick peaks, generate the constellation map, create all the hash pairs, and then query the reference database. For each reference segment, we get back a set of matching hashes with their time offsets in the generated audio. We aggregate those into a consensus time range, and that tells us exactly where to slice.
The accuracy is remarkable. We're typically locating segments to within about 50 milliseconds of their actual boundaries. That's more than precise enough for clean cuts. No clipped words, no awkward gaps.
What's interesting is that this is essentially the inverse of the Shazam use case. Shazam takes a short, unknown clip and matches it against a database of full reference tracks. We're taking a full unknown track and matching it against a database of short reference clips. The underlying algorithm is identical. The only thing that changes is which side is the query and which side is the reference.
The database is tiny by comparison. Shazam has to index millions of songs. Our reference database has maybe a dozen segments. The lookup is essentially instantaneous.
Daniel mentioned that we're planning to use this for what he called episodes. Episodes that are assembled from fragments of previous episodes, stitched together automatically using fingerprint-based location. The idea is that you can specify segments by their content rather than their timestamps, and the pipeline handles the rest.
Think of it as content-addressed audio editing. Instead of saying use the segment from 3 minutes 12 seconds to 4 minutes 5 seconds, you say use the segment where we discussed spectrogram peak picking, and the fingerprinting system finds it for you. Across different TTS generations, across different voice models, across different episodes entirely.
There's a deeper principle here that I think is worth pulling out. Timestamps are fragile metadata. They break the moment anything about the underlying file changes, different encoding, different playback speed, different TTS generation. Content-based addressing is robust because it derives its reference points from the signal itself. The audio contains its own index.
This is the same principle behind content address storage in systems like Git or IPFS. You don't refer to a file by its location or its modification date. You refer to it by a hash of its contents. The address is derived from the thing itself. Audio fingerprinting extends that idea into the time domain. You're not just identifying which file, you're identifying where within the file, based entirely on the content.
It handles partial matches gracefully. If you're looking for a segment and only part of it appears in the target audio, you'll still get some hash matches. The voting mechanism will show a weaker but still detectable spike. You can set confidence thresholds based on how many hashes need to agree before you consider it a match.
Let's talk about failure modes, because no algorithm is perfect. What breaks fingerprinting?
Extreme pitch shifting is the biggest vulnerability. If you shift the audio by more than about a semitone or two, the frequency peaks start landing in different bins and the hashes stop matching. Time stretching beyond about 5 to 10% also causes problems because the time deltas in the hash pairs no longer align with the reference values. Very heavy compression at low bitrates can wipe out enough spectral detail that peak picking fails to find consistent features.
There's an interesting edge case with spoken word versus music. Music has a lot of simultaneous frequencies. Harmonics, instrumentation, which creates a rich, dense constellation map with lots of peaks to work with. Spoken word is sparser. A single voice has fewer simultaneous frequencies, so you get fewer peaks per time window. That means you need longer audio segments to get enough hashes for a confident match.
That's exactly why we chose our reference segments carefully. The disclaimer is about 15 seconds long, which gives us plenty of peaks even with a single voice. And we deliberately included words with strong fricatives and plosives. S sounds, T sounds, P sounds, P sounds, because those create broadband spectral bursts that generate lots of peaks in a short time.
Hilbert's fun fact intro, and now Hilbert's daily fun fact, is only about 3 seconds, but it's highly distinctive. The word Hilbert has that sharp H onset followed by the L and the plosive B and T. It fingerprints beautifully.
There's another use case for this that I think is underappreciated. Podcast chapters and dynamic ad insertion. If you fingerprint the chapter markers or the ad breakpoints, you can locate them in any encoding of the episode regardless of the file format, bitrate, or slight variations in the intro music. The content itself tells you where the break is.
Unlike watermarking, you're not adding anything to the audio. You're just reading what's already there. There's no degradation, no audible artifact, nothing that a listener could possibly detect. The fingerprint is purely an interpretation of the existing signal.
The computational cost is also worth mentioning because it's surprisingly low. The Fourier transform is the most expensive step, and modern processors handle that trivially for audio. The peak picking and hash generation are simple operations on sparse data. On a typical podcast episode of 30 minutes, the entire fingerprinting process takes less than a second on a modern CPU. It's not a bottleneck.
Which is why Shazam could work on 2003 smartphone hardware. The algorithm was designed to be efficient from the start. Avery Wang's insight was that you don't need to understand the audio. You don't need to separate instruments, transcribe notes, or do any kind of semantic analysis. You just need to find a sparse set of distinctive points and encode their relative positions. It's aggressively dumb in the best possible way.
Aggressively dumb is exactly right. The algorithm has no idea what music is. It doesn't know what a note is, what a chord is, what a voice is. It's purely pattern matching on spectral peaks, and that's why it generalizes so well. The same algorithm works on music, speech, animal calls, industrial machinery sounds, anything with a detectable spectral structure.
There's a philosophical angle here that I can't resist. The algorithm works by throwing away almost all the information and keeping only the relationships that survive degradation. It's a kind of platonic ideal of the audio, the essential structural skeleton that persists across all the messy, lossy, noisy instantiations. What remains after you strip away everything that can be stripped away?
The constellation map metaphor reinforces that. Stars in the sky look different from different places on Earth, at different times of night, through different amounts of atmospheric distortion. But the relative positions, the constellations, are invariant. You can navigate by them regardless of local conditions.
To bring it back to our pipeline, we've essentially taught our production system to navigate by the stars. It doesn't need to know how long the episode is or what timestamps to expect. It just looks for the constellations it recognizes and orients itself accordingly.
The episode idea Daniel mentioned takes this a step further. Once you can locate segments by content rather than position, you can build episodes that are content assembled. You specify the topics you want to include. The pipeline searches through the archive of generated audio, fingerprint, matches the relevant discussions, and stitches them together with appropriate transitions. The editing decisions are driven by what's being said, not by where it happens to fall in a timeline.
This is one of those technologies that's been hiding in plain sight for 20 years. Shazam launched commercially in 2002. Content ID launched in 2007. The core patent by Avery Wang and Julia Smith was filed in 2000. And yet, most people, including most technologists, have no idea how it actually works.
I think part of the reason is that it feels like it should be an AI problem. Song recognition sounds like something that requires understanding music, key detection, tempo analysis, instrument identification. The fact that it's solved by a dumb spectral hashing algorithm with no semantic understanding whatsoever is almost disappointing. It's too simple to be impressive at first glance.
Until you think about the scale. Matching a noisy 10-second clip against 100 million tracks in under a second, using an algorithm that runs comfortably on a phone from 15 years ago. The simplicity is the achievement.
The robustness across degradation types is remarkable. The original Shazam paper includes test results showing accurate identification with GSM compression. That's the codec used for old-school mobile phone calls, which is absolutely brutal to audio quality. It works through significant background noise, through re-recording from speakers, through all the ways audio gets mangled in the real world.
Let me ask you something. When we were building our pipeline, what was the moment where you thought, okay, this is actually going to work?
The first time we ran it on a test episode and it correctly located the disclaimer to within 200 milliseconds, I actually laughed out loud. Because it felt like magic, even though I understood exactly how it worked. We had generated the episode with a different TTS engine than the one we used for the reference fingerprints. Different voice characteristics, slightly different pacing. And the hashes still matched. That's when I knew the approach was sound.
The different TTS engine is a good stress test. Different voices have different spectral characteristics, different harmonic content, different formant frequencies. If the fingerprinting can survive a complete voice change, it can survive essentially anything our pipeline is going to throw at it.
The one thing we had to tune was the peak density. With the single speaker, as I mentioned, you get fewer peaks per time window than you would with music. We had to lower the peak picking threshold slightly to ensure we were capturing enough points for reliable matching. But that's a one-time calibration. Once you've set it for your particular audio domain, it's stable.
Now the fun facts segment is essentially self-locating. Hilbert says, and now Hilbert's daily fun fact, and the pipeline knows exactly where that happened without anyone telling it.
Which is going to make the episodes dramatically easier to produce. Instead of manually marking timestamps for every segment we might want to reuse, we just maintain the fingerprint database and let the system find everything automatically. It's the kind of automation that quietly eliminates an enormous amount of tedious manual work.
There's a broader lesson here about system design. When you find yourself depending on fragile metadata, timestamps, file names, directory structures, ask whether you can derive what you need from the content itself. Content-based addressing almost always scales better and breaks less often.
Audio fingerprinting is just one instance of that principle. Perceptual hashing for images works on similar ideas. Reduce the image to its essential structural features and hash those. Video fingerprinting extends it into the temporal dimension. The same pattern shows up across domains.
Daniel's question. Why fingerprint-based location beats timestamp-based slicing for variable-length TTS output? The answer is that timestamps are a brittle external coordinate system imposed on content that doesn't care about them. Fingerprints are derived from the content itself. When the content shifts, the fingerprints shift with it. The relationship is intrinsic rather than imposed.
That's the sentence I want listeners to walk away with. Intrinsic rather than imposed. It's the difference between navigating by GPS coordinates and navigating by landmarks. The GPS coordinates might be wrong if the map is slightly misaligned. The landmark is always exactly where it is.
All right, I think we've covered the mechanics, the use cases, and the example. Should we do Hilbert's fun fact?
Go for it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds.
A lot of cloud.
I'm going to think about that every time I look up now.
Which is probably the point. This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.